piano concerto in G major by Maurice Ravel, Alain Grimaud, the soloist, the Baltimore Symphony, conducted by David Zinman. And of course, Ravel said famously about writing that slow movement, he said, "It almost killed me." Yes. How is playing it? It's got to be very tough.
It is difficult. The use of the pedal is a very tricky element. This 3-4-2 rhythm is also difficult to manage in the sense that it brings this imbalance, but it's good to keep that. You know, you don't want something which is too square or too stable either. And it's always the challenge, I think, in Ravel's music is to find this ideal mix between coolness and sensuality, at least in that movement for sure, with all of these unresolved harmonies. It's a sublime phrase, and it seems so serene if you look at the melody in the right hand, but then that left hand always comes to disturb that and bring that darkness and that uncertainty. So it's a wonderful piece of music, and it's always interesting to me to think that, you know, he said that composing was 75% an intellectual activity. I don't want to say exercise, I think he said activity. And it's really fascinating because it seems really to come straight from the heart. But, you know, he worked on that piece for 2 years. But it's wonderful. And when you know how interested he was in jazz, and I mean, jazz was so popular in Paris at that time. I think he was in the U.S. on tour in 28, I think, and then met Gershwin. I think he met him then. And it's funny because sometimes people think that Gershwin was influenced by Ravel, but I think it was really the other way around, in fact.
Oh, absolutely.
And this idea that the rhythmic element in the music in jazz, you know, becomes an expressive element, not just a kinetic force in the music. It's really very, very interesting. And that piece, the only problem with that piece, I find, is that it's over too quickly.
Yes, yes. And I think the most astonishing thing is he wrote the D major concerto at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, how does one do that?
Two different planets.
Yeah, how did Mozart write the C major concerto and the D minor concerto simultaneously? I mean,
it's mind-boggling.
Well, obviously, I've been joined by one of the world's great pianists. Alain Grimaud is in town to play that very work, the G major piano concerto of Maurice Ravel, with Lionel Bronguier and the Los Angeles Philharmonic this weekend. She stopped in tonight. We're going to play a few of her many recordings and talk about precisely what we feel like talking about. Alain Grimaud, welcome back to KUSC.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be back.
Well, since we last talked, you've had a number of recordings that have come out. And just before it came out, when you were here last time,
You
were talking about the Water Project, which turned out to be absolutely stunning.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I played the program, actually, in my last recital, so it will not be returning too soon. You know, there might be a revisiting of that music in perhaps a decade from now. But I played the program a lot, and very fortunately in LA as well, at the Disney Hall, which is one of my favorite venues in the world. But now I'm, you know, leaving it to rest and moving on to other things.
Yes. For instance, the Memory album.
Yes.
Maybe a word about that. I mean, it's a lot of very interesting.
Yes, actually the two are connected because the Memory album was born out of the collaboration with Nitin Soni on the Water Project. And when I commissioned him to write these transitions or bridges to go between the pieces of the Water album, we talked about taking the collaboration to the next level, perhaps in a follow-up project where we would actually play together instead of in sequence. And interestingly enough, I mean, Nitin is classically trained, and God bless him, he has this amazing reverence for the classical repertoire. And at the end, I think he just didn't feel that it was a good idea to, for lack of a better word, to mess with this music. And his reverence for the material is actually moving and inspiring. And so we had a different idea then, which was that I would go about doing my work. And then Nitin worked on an echo, so to say, which is supposed to come as an EP in a few months from now.
I see. I see. Well, speaking of reverent, from the rather, rumor has it, irreverent Erik Satie, a lot of it, I think, was put on, but a lot of it was genuine eccentricity. I mean, he was an absolutely strange man.
Yes.
And said some wonderful things.
Yes.
Like, they always told me when I was young, you'll see. Now that I'm old, I see nothing. And it's wonderful.
Yes, I mean, it fits perfectly. It's fascinating music because there is that stillness, but it's ever-changing. So all of these repeated phrases or segments of phrases, they always come back, and some of his indications are completely out there in terms of, you know, what he's telling you about what frame of mind you're supposed to be in when you're about to play these notes, on the border of absurd, but they always have a powerful effect. And the music is, it's very transparent, it's very modest, and it has that, you know, that distance to life, to destiny, and there's something very healthy about it, actually.
There is. We were chatting about Chopin, and you told me you've never been to Chopin's grave.
Correct. But fortunately, you have, so
yes.
You've shared some of that experience, but I definitely should do that someday.
Yeah. Yeah, his nose is a little chipped. Mm. That's the only problem.
Okay.
I know he was born in Poland, and I know he wrote all of those mazurkas and those polonaises and so forth, mm-hmm. but he was French for all practical purposes, don't you think?
I still think of him as having a Slavic soul, but perhaps French elegance, if there is such a thing, or aristocratic feeling. I think there is something very dignified about Chopin's music, but what I love is to always feel sometimes this rage, even. There is this passion, but there is this colère, we would say in my language, you know, this anger. And it's a wonderful motor for the emotions in the music, and whether those are patriotic feelings or feelings of maybe personal slight. I mean, you know, he's someone who's very tormented and suffered actually a lot, and you feel it in that music. And for all of its beauty, and sometimes, well, there isn't very much serenity there. Even when you have a very still, one of these Proustian, you know, phrases, never-ending melodies, there's so much nostalgia to the music, this melancholic feeling, this looking back. That's the way I feel it. And somehow I always feel sad for him or sad with him. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he was a guy without many friends.
Yes,
he was a very
lonely,
prickly, difficult guy. Mm-hmm. In that, he was a lot like Mozart, you know, who was also very difficult to be around by all accounts. So, yeah, and I mean, and Georges Sand, it was kind of a perfect fit. And when it went smash, so did his creativity.
Mm. That's tragic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but these two must have had a very, very tormented story. But I think, you know, most of these composers, I can't imagine that any of them, even when they were commissioned, and it was for the purpose of divertissement or, I guess, entertainment at the time or its version, I feel that all of these pieces reach so deep. They're never something that is meant as purely well-packaged, simply beautifully played in a plastic sort of way. The plasticity of it, I mean, not the material. They're really mad pieces by mad people.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Otherwise, that music would have never been born.
Yeah. 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 The corollary is, if you want the girl next door, go next door. But when you go to the opera house, you don't want the girl next door.
Exactly.
You know, you want a lunatic soprano cutting loose on all cylinders. So every month, the Gramophone magazine in London, they do what they call a collections article. And some critic takes a listen to just about every recorded performance of the piece they're considering that month. You know, the guy listens to 50 recordings of whatever it is. And a couple of years ago, they did this with the Gershwin Concerto in F. And guess which one came out on top?
Well, thanks for telling me. I had no idea.
Yeah, it was. And it was, you know, it's a pretty, there have been some pretty terrific recordings of this piece. So you were going up against some people who really know this piece.
Indeed.
And, you know, your recording, it is, as we implied earlier, you know, the cross-fertilization between Ravel and mm-hmm. all French things and George Gershwin. But it's also intensely American.
Yes.
Your performance.
Well, you know, I had the help, of course, of the Baltimore Symphony and David Zinman. And it's a piece which actually I never performed. I took it to Baltimore. We played it in the subscription and then recorded it immediately at the end of that week. So there was that one performance and then a recording. So, and after that, I played it only a handful of times, if that. And so, and it's really too bad. And it's good that you bring up the Concerto in F, because it's a piece which is not really played much anymore. And it's a great piece of music. So I should go back to it.
Yeah, yeah. And the story, by the way, is absolutely true, that when Walter Damrosch commissioned it, he went out and bought a music dictionary and looked up what concerto was. He wasn't quite sure.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I did not know.
I think there's almost a movie to be made out of the life of Valentin Silvestrov, this Ukrainian composer who, during the height of the bad Soviet times, decided he's going to write 12-tone music, which means no performances anywhere. And then the Soviet Union collapses, and he suddenly goes in the opposite direction, writing this music that is so deceptively simple and so intensely moving that I think he's one of the great composers alive today. I think you probably agree.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I was very fortunate to discover his music. It was actually a gift from Manfred Eicher from ECM. It was the double recording of the Silent Songs. And it was really an arresting experience. I remember sitting there in that dark living room listening to that music that first evening, and I could not do anything else. I was absolutely transfixed. There is such power to this music. And I mean, you said it so beautifully, but it has that shimmering transparency, this simplicity, which is so disarming, and it communicates so much. It conveys so many deeply moving emotions and memories and visions, and it's really quite magical.
It is. Yeah. It is. The Silent Songs, this is this hour and 45-minute song cycle.
Yes.
Which never rises above a piano.
Exactly.
And in fact, the person singing sings into the piano, as opposed to directly to the audience.
So exactly.
It's as if he doesn't really want anybody to hear it. You know, it's just one of these miraculous.
So, it's so intimate, and it's actually, it is one of my deep wishes to do this piece in concert. I have yet to find the right partner for it. Mm. I've been looking for a few years, but it's a lot of work for someone to learn, for the singer. So still working on that, but I really hope to be able to do this sometime soon.
Yeah, the bagatelles, again, are just sort of indescribable. They don't sound like anybody else.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And they are hardly real. I mean, there's unreal quality about them. So you hear them and you're not really sure, is this really happening? Is this really there? It's so immaterial, but it really draws you in. It's very powerful. I wasn't sure if that would happen, especially in the live context. I just started playing the program now in the beginning of this year. And the program opens with these two bagatelles. And I was thinking, well, this could be difficult because, you know, when people sit down and there's always that moment where you need to settle and find your center, who knows what your day was made of. You arrive, you sit down in the concert hall, and, you know, it happens that people can be the first few minutes slightly fidgety, perhaps. And I thought, but this music does it every single time from the very first note. And perhaps because of the dynamics, as you said, it all moves between triple pianissimo and, you know, mezzo piano, if that.
So for this recording of a couple of Mozart piano concertos, there's no conductor listed, which means you sort of did what Mozart did when the things were introduced for the first time. You sort of led from the piano.
Yes, yes and no, I have to say, because I did not gesticulate in any way, shape, or form. So the work really happened in the rehearsals. And when one is lucky enough to work with a chamber orchestra of this caliber, it's, frankly speaking, relatively easy because you have such a strong unit next to you. And of course, with a leader also of that strength, which the Bayerische Rundfunkkammerorchester has, it was a beautiful, beautiful collaboration. I'm not a fan of the word, but you know what I mean. And this is what I love about the process, is this is one of these projects where rehearsals are everything. So it's not, you know, sometimes when you arrive somewhere and you play with a symphonic orchestra, of course you have this working rehearsal and you have the dress rehearsal. If you're lucky, you have multiple subscription concerts, or perhaps you're touring, so you have, you know, the advantage of repeated performances even in different cities where the bond can continue to get stronger and you grow together through the interpretation. But a project like this, it's really luxury because you rehearse so much more. And I find that to be absolutely wonderful because it's really all happening in those days prior to the first performance. And then, of course, the performances will all change because that's what live performance does. It's never twice the same, regardless. But it's this closeness. It's really like chamber music with more colleagues on stage. And that I loved very much.
Yeah. And I really think that the Bavarian Radio Symphony is now the equal of the Berlin Philharmonic. There, I've said it, and I'm glad.
Well, and I second.
Yeah, I mean, they're just a stupendous band. You plan to do anything like this again sometime soon?
Actually, yes. There's a project with Camerata Salzburg, and it will be a mixed program with some solo Mozart pieces. C minor fantasy and C minor sonata, and then the D minor fantasy followed by the D minor concerto with Kammerata Salzburg.
Any other projects on the horizon?
Yes, of course. Well, we'll go back to solo repertoire. So after the next project, if we're thinking about recordings after the Mozart, then I will go to Schubert, actually. So it has been a long time coming. Better late than never.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So many pianists, I mean, I can't even begin to list them, who have been on this show. Mm-hmm. At a certain stage in their career, they say, now it's time for Schubert. Because yeah. Arthur Schnabel said famously, Beethoven, I play to make a living. Schubert, I play for love.
Yes, I cannot exactly subscribe to that point of view necessarily, but fine. And yes, but there is something about Schubert's music, which is the public aspect of that music is somehow superfluous. Again, because the music is so intimate, it has a testament-like quality always. And it's sort of stream of consciousness music in a way, you know. Actually, it makes me think of something Ravel said supposedly about how one doesn't need to wear one's heart on one's sleeve to prove one has a soul. I don't know why I just thought of that. It really has nothing to do with Schubert, except that there is that very unforced, very natural, and totally candid sort of sense of vulnerability in the music. And it makes it a very personal experience. And, I mean, I always think of his music as something that you can spend time with, live with. You wouldn't necessarily have to actually take it to the stage.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Thinking of any of the late sonatas?
Yes.
Yeah, I would imagine. Which are, I think, as tough to do as late Beethoven. You know, as mysterious.
Yes.
And as basically not really doable, yes, in the sense that something else Schnabel said, you know, I'm only interested in playing music that's better than can be played.
I love this. I have to remember this. This is brilliant.
Yeah, he's said a lot of interesting things. And in fact, you probably know that famous cycle of the Mozart piano concertos he did in Vienna in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Most of them were last heard in that city when Mozart himself introduced them more than a century earlier. So,
there you go.
Yeah. So,
how scary is that?
It's very scary. It's very scary. And that's the scary and the wonderful thing about this music. You never run out of it. There's always something.
True.
There's always something. Yes. And when you're next in town, stop in. It's been too long since your last visit.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be back.